Ah, the joy of reading a good book. I've been able to read a lot of good books recently, or I will confess, I've been listening to them more on audiobooks, because when you have little kids, sometimes that's the only way that you can do it. But I'm really enjoying it, so I wanted to talk about that today. And in particular, I wanted to talk about literary point of view, because I'm thinking about it more since I've been reading a wide variety of classic fiction novels recently. So that's what we're going to chat about. Mondays and Wednesdays, we talk apologetics and theology. But on Friday, we talk about really whatever I want to talk about. And today, that's what I want to talk about. Really, for the past 15 years, it's felt like most of the reading and learning that I have been doing has been in the world of nonfiction. I mean, I want to do Catholic apologetics. I love helping people learn about their faith, learn about God, learn about the church, learn about Jesus, and answering critics of Catholicism and Christianity, answering people who defend evils like legal abortion or euthanasia. So in order to do that, there are millions and millions of pages out there, things I couldn't read it in a lifetime. I need 100 lifetimes, if that, to go through all of it. So I've always felt this burden that, okay, I need to learn all these arguments. I got to read journal articles. I have to learn about, and I cover a wide variety of fields in the different subjects that I address. So it might be science and cosmology, philosophy, ancient history, linguistics, languages, European history, American history, all different kinds of issues come up. So I've had to cover a lot of different ground, different areas. And so in that reading, I feel like I've really neglected fiction and classics and just really reading for fun. It is hard. Even when I'm off work, sometimes I feel like, oh, I could read this article, or oh, I could read about this. And there's a sense of guilt, like, oh, I could learn more. But now I feel like the times when I'm not working, it's like, okay, it's time to really dial back. It's time to dial back and save your engine so that you're not experiencing burnout. So I can have time to say, no, I want to just sit back. I don't have to be learning about things 24/7. But honestly, though, one of the best ways to become a really good apologist is not to read nonfiction books over and over and over again. Some of the greatest apologists are people who are well-versed in fiction, in literature, in stories, because they use those analogies and examples when they talk. I mean, one of the best proponents of the new atheism was Christopher Hitchens, right? Hitchens was not a scientist like Dawkins. He's not a philosopher like Daniel Dennett. He wasn't a neuroscientist like Sam Harris, but he was a journalist, a literary critic, and Hitchens was someone that was clearly well-read, widely read, and so he could make allusions and make historical connections that could seem profound to some people, but really were interesting insights. And he did have interesting insights on a wide variety of things. There's a lot of stuff that he got wrong. There's other stuff that he got right, too. But listening to him, you can feel the weight of his arguments more with some of that wider knowledge of things, especially the European canon of literature and things like that. So I think if you want to be a good presenter of the faith and you want to present things to people, not just reading apologetic books, but I mean, think about, you know, Fulton Sheen, for example, or I mean, even think of St. Paul. He was able to quote the Greek Stoics, Stoic philosophers and Greek philosophers. Acts 17 records this when he was debating with the Greeks in Athens. So you need to be able to have a wide variety at your hand. And it's just fun. It enriches the soul to read classic literature. So I've been going through a lot of different kinds of classic literature. And when you read a lot of different kinds of books, you'll notice one thing that sets books apart is their point of view. All right. So the different point of view in the story that you're reading. So I want to go through each point of view, discuss its kind of its strengths and its weaknesses, and the ones that I tend to prefer, though not exclusively, but the ones that I tend to prefer. So let's start with the points of view. There are really three main points of view and some subsets of some of those points. So the first one would be first person. So first person point of view is you are seeing the world of the novel through the eyes of a particular character. So the words that are used frequently are I. Sometimes it might be we, but typically it's I. I did this, I did that. And it is a person telling you their story, they're experiencing it. They might be telling it in flashback. They might be right in the midst of it, saying it to you. So it's not a retrospective. So classic example of this would be Moby Dick. So the opening of Moby Dick. Call me Ishmael. All right, now we know who you are, because he's telling the story from his perspective. He's got to talk to you. Call me Ishmael. Some years ago, never mind how long precisely, having little or no money in my purse, nothing particular to interest me on shore, I thought I would sail about a little and see the watery part of the world. It's a way I have of driving off the spleen and regulating the circulation. Whenever I find myself growing grim about the mouth, whenever it is a damp, drizzly November in my soul, whenever I find myself involuntarily pausing before coffin warehouses, oh my, grim, and bringing up the rear of every funeral I meet, and especially whenever my hypos get such an upper hand of me, that it requires a strong moral principle to prevent me from deliberately stepping into the street and methodically knocking people's hats off, then I account it high time Taws get to see as soon as I can. And so for the story of Moby Dick, we understand who Ishmael is, and through his eyes we understand, you know, Captain Ahab and his obsession. And of course, when you're writing a story, not just first person, but whose perspective are you going to tell it from? Right? So whose perspective are you going to tell it from? Like, Moby Dick would be a lot different if the story were told from Ahab's perspective or the whale's perspective. You could tell it in that way. And this is similar when you look at The Great Gatsby, for example. A lot of people think that Gatsby is the main character of the story, but he's not. Nick is, Nick Carraway. And so Nick presents everything through his eyes, and it presents the story in a particular slanted view that where Gatsby, if he were telling it to us, it may not be as, I mean, I think Carraway and Great Gatsby, when he's telling the story, it is slanted still. I mean, any first person perspective is going to be slanted a bit. Sometimes it's really slanted. And that would be the case of an unreliable narrator. I'll get to that shortly. But in Gatsby, for example, if having Nick there allows us to look at Gatsby and really, you know, see him in a way different than if Gatsby were telling us the story from his eyes, because, of course, involving things like, you know, figuring out Gatsby's past and things like that, it wouldn't work. A lot of times first person is used in a story that you'll have someone go in. They are just the regular person. They are the regular person taken along for the journey who doesn't know as much as the other characters, just like we are. This happens in movies, too. And so they have to get kind of caught up to speed on things, and then that catches the reader up to speed from that first-person perspective. Another one would be Great Expectations by Charles Dickens. I remember that one. I read that. I should really get back to Dickensian literature. I didn't like it when I was a kid. I don't think I'll still like it now. I think I remember the opening of Great Expectations. It went something like this. My English name being Pirip, and my Christian name being Philip, my infant tongue can only sound the name Pip, and hence my name came to be. Just call me Pip. Is that, come on, man. Dickens, I think he wrote by the words. So that's why it can be a bit much to drag through there. So that is one thing that's nice. It gets you right into the heart of it. You have direct access to what the character's thinking. You can really understand them, you know, their thoughts and their feelings without it being cumbersome. Imagine the third person here. We'll get to that. But somebody else saying how Ishmael, you know, when he thinks about killing himself or hurting other people or being a nuisance, he needs to go to sea. So first person works well there. Sometimes, though, first person can be a perspective where you're in the head of some character and you don't really want to be there. You don't like them, or you're just not a fan. So one example of this would be, although a lot of it will reflect on the author's writing style, consider Twilight. It's not a classic, obviously, but it was a very popular book back in the early 2000s by Stephanie Meyer. Twilight's a story about vampires that sparkle in the sun and like to pretend that they're in high school for hundreds of years. I know. So Twilight by Stephanie Meyer, written in 2005. Here's how it opens here. It was to Forks that I now exiled myself, an action that I took with great horror. I detested Forks. I loved Phoenix. I loved the sun and the blistering heat. I loved the vigorous, sprawling city. Bella, my mom said to me, the last of a thousand times before I got on the plane, you don't have to do this. My mom looks like me, except with short hair and laugh lines. I felt a spasm of panic as I stared at her wide, childlike eyes. I'm not going to continue on because I can't. I already don't like this person. but also the line, my mom looks like me, except with short hair and laugh lines. That's a meaningless description. Because at this point, at the beginning of the story, we don't know what Bella looks like. And you guys say, well, you know, you could just imagine. Well, I can't imagine. I would assume that if this is Bella's biological mother, she's going to look like her. I would assume she'd probably look like, you might as well have just said, my mom has short hair and laugh lines. Oh, goodness. So now sometimes the first person, what makes it really interesting is you have an unreliable narrator. So you can use someone who is describing the world, but you might think, oh, wait a minute, the world isn't exactly as how they describe it. They're warping things. They can't be trusted necessarily. Either they're completely lying or they're distorting reality. And that's how a lot of people live, right? They'll think the world is one way when it's actually quite different. And great novels communicate that. One that uses this would be Vladimir Nabokov's 1955 novel Lolita, which is a story about a child molester, child rapist, Humbert Humbert. He marries a woman just so he can have access to her 12-year-old daughter, Dolores, who he calls Lolita. The mom dies, and then he grooms and he rapes Lolita. He gets his comeuppance later in the story. But when you read through it, you see how he has a deceptive way of talking about things. He's been in and out. He talks about being in and out of insane asylums, that his description of things can't be trusted. The way he describes Lolita as seducing him and charming him, the astute reader has to go, no, that's not what's happening here. That's what he's telling himself to justify the evil things that he's doing. When in other cases, he lets the cat out of the bag that this is a little girl, 4'10" in a sock, as he describes her, not someone who is seducing and charming him and reeling him in. But you have to be astute when you're going through things like that. So first person perspective puts you are looking at the story through the eyes of one of the characters, okay? The second most common one is going to be third person. I'll get to that shortly, but I do need to talk about one that is hardly ever used because it's very, very, very difficult to do. And that would be second person. So first person uses I, third person uses he, she, second person uses you. So second person is you are looking at the story through the eyes of the main character, but the main character is not someone else. The main character is you. You are in the story and describes you in that way. So here is the opening of Jay McInerney's 1984 novel, Bright Lights, Big City, which was later made into a film with Michael J. Fox. You're not the kind of guy who would be at a place like this at this time in the morning, but here you are. You cannot say that the terrain is entirely unfamiliar. Although the details are fuzzy, you are at a nightclub talking to a girl with a shaved head. The club is either Heartbreak or the Lizard Lounge. All might come clear if you could just slip into the bathroom and do a little more Bolivian marching powder. Then again, it might not. Cocaine. It's your typical 1980s high-powered novel. 1980s businessmen hitting up cocaine, going to wild parties, stock markets, riding it high, things like that. So second person can be good if there is an interesting character who's a first-person perspective, and the reader might enjoy pretending to be that person and that they're along for the ride as if they were that person. So McInerney talks about how you might want to be this person who lives this risky life, high gain, possibly high loss, that you might find it fascinating. But it can really come off cheesy, weird, or unenjoyable if it's a character you don't want to get in the eyes of. So in general, that's why you hardly ever see this in novels. It's very, very rare. The closest you'll see second person would be in the old Choose Your Own Adventure books. When I was a kid, I loved these books in the school library. It's like, the Adventure in the Amazon. If you take the path down the valley, turn to page 52. If you take the path up the mountain, page 63, up the mountain. A giant vulture grabbed you and flew off and dropped you into the gorge. You died. Ah, come on, man. But that's how they were. There were all different kinds of things like that. Some of the old Choose Your Own Adventures, I have a free-for-all on that I did a long, long time ago, how the old ones were really grim. You'd get assassinated by people, or in the science fiction ones, you could end up immortal, trapped in a test tube forever, shrunken down, or just other weird things. But second person, you really can only use it in those Choose Your Own Adventures where it's like you decide the story, things like that. But like I said, first person is very common. The other one, probably even more common than first person, is third person. Third person would be that the perspective on the story that you're reading is someone else who is not involved in the story. It is told from the perspective of someone else who is watching the characters interact. So one of the most common ones would be third person omniscient. And basically for shorthand, this would be if God is watching the story and is telling you what is happening. Third person omniscient would be the narrator knows all, sees all, knows everything that has happened, will happen, is happening, and even knows what each of the characters is thinking. And so that I'll show you that. That would be, here's an example from Frank Herbert's 1965 novel, Dune. The Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Moyam sat in a tapestried chair watching mother and son approach. Windows on each side of her overlooked the curving southern bend of the river and the green farmlands of the Atreides family holding. But the Reverend Mother ignored the view. She was feeling her age this morning, more than a little petulant. She blamed it on space travel, an association with that abominable spacing guild and its secretive ways. But here was a mission that required personal attention from a Bene Gesserit with the sight. Even the Padishah Emperor's truce-sayer couldn't evade that responsibility when the duty all came. Damn that Jessica, the Reverend Mother thought. If only she'd borne us a girl as she was ordered to do. Jessica stopped 3 paces from the chair, dropping a small curtsy, a gentle flick of left hand along the line of her skirt. Paul gave the short bow his dancing master had taught, the one used when in doubt of another station. Jessica's hand went to Paul's shoulder, tightened there for a heartbeat, fear pulsed through her palm. Then she had herself under control. This, thus he has been taught, your reverence. What does she fear? Paul wondered. So you notice there what third person omniscient is doing. It's like we're up in heaven looking down on this story and we know what they're thinking, what they're doing, and we're seeing it all. And that can be a great way to tell a story, to really make clear to us what people are thinking, what they are doing. And so you have this very immersive experience in seeing all and knowing all. The downside is that since it's so easy to write this way, people can often write it in horrible ways. I have read, it's such an easy way, it can become a lazy way of writing. I've read books where once Cardinal Sin is head hopping, where he thought this, and then she thought that, and then he did this, and he thought that, and we're just hopping around, and we don't have a sense of space and scale, and it can become confusing. Or there's talky. It's a lot of telling me. The narrator gives a bunch of exposition about this fantasy kingdom and how it was created, and what Lord Salvenstein thought, and he loved her, and this and that. It's like, oh, we get it already. A lot of tell more than show. So third-person omniscient, it's easy to fall apart in that way. That's why a lot of skilled writers will use a third person, and this is the one that I think I kind of like the most, is third-person limited. This is a third person. This would be not if God is watching the story as the point of view, but if a security camera was watching the story. And it's varied, but sometimes you'll have other characters, side characters be the third-person point of view. But imagine if you were reading a story and it's just like a security camera was looking at it and telling us what it saw. So this is a style in Dashiell Hammett's 1930 novel, The Maltese Falcon, which was later made into a film, 2 films, I think, actually. But it was made into a film with Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall, I want to say. So in Maltese Falcon, in the novel, it does not talk about what the characters are thinking. It only, you have to deduce what they are thinking based on the descriptions that Hammett gives of the characters and what they are doing, even the expressions on their faces. And that makes it really enjoyable. It's kind of like watching a movie, and you know, you're using your mind. I'm not saying every novel has to be done this way. All the other perspectives are good. But I really enjoy this of trying to discern what people are thinking just based on these descriptions. So here's an excerpt from The Maltese Falcon. Samuel Spade's jaw was long and bony, his chin a jutting V under the more flexible V of his mouth. His nostrils curved back to make another smaller V. His yellow-gray eyes were horizontal. The V motif was picked up again by thickish brows rising outward from twin creases above a hooked nose. And his pale brown hair grew down from high, flat temples in a point on his forehead. He looked rather pleasantly like a blonde Satan. He said to Effie Perrin, by the way, Spade is a detective in San Francisco, as said in the 1920s, and Effie Perrin is his secretary, and he is dragged into a case about trying to find a lost medieval artifact, the Maltese Falcon. Supposed to, you know, it's worth a ton of money, and everybody's after it, and people are lying, and there's murders that happen, and people take the fall for murders or cover it up, and it's a great example of film noir in the Humphrey Bogart version. But it's one of the top 10 crime novels, mystery novels of all time. So he said to Effie Perrin, "Yes, sweetheart." She was a lanky, sunburned girl whose tan dress of thin woolen stuff clung to her with an effect of dampness. Her eyes were brown and playful in a shiny, boyish face. She finished shutting the door behind her, leaned against it, and said, "There's a girl wants to see you. Her name's Wonderly." "Customer?" "I guess so. You'll want to see her anyway. She's a knockout." "Shoo her in, darling," said Spade. "Shoo her in." Effie Perrin opened the door again, following it back into the outer office, standing with a hand on the knob while saying, "Will you come in, Miss Wonderly?" A voice said, "Thank you," so softly that only the purest articulation made the words intelligible, and a young woman came through the doorway. She advanced slowly, with tentative steps, looking at Spade with cobalt blue eyes that were both shy and probing. She was tall and pliantly slender, without angularity anywhere, and her body was erect, her legs long, her hands and feet narrow. She wore 2 shades of blue that had been selected because of her eyes. The hair curling from under her blue hat was darkly red, her full lips more brightly red. White teeth glistened in the crescent of her timid smile. Spade rose, bowing and indicating with a thick-fingered hand the oaken armchair beside his desk. He was quite 6 feet tall. The steep, rounded slope of his shoulders made his body seem almost conical, no broader than it was thick, and kept his freshly pressed gray coat from fitting very well. Miss Wonderly murmured, "Thank you," softly as before, and sat down on the edge of the chair's wooden seat. So notice here, you don't have to say she's scared and nervous. Now, it does talk about her tone being timid, but even like talking about her posture, how she sits, sitting at the edge of one seat, like how a child might sit, being, you know, very soft-spoken, whereas Spade, the detective, exhibits this, you know, kind of confidence, and the physical description of him gives you that he's kind of the, I would say that, you know, it's very, Humphrey Bogart was a perfect casting for this. It's kind of the proto Harrison Ford, cool, charismatic, tough guy who knows what's going on. The tappity-tap-tap and the thin bell and muffled whir of Effie Perrin's typewriting came through the closed door. Somewhere in a neighboring office, a power-driven machine vibrated dully. On Spade's desk, a limp cigarette smoldered in a brass tray filled with the remains of limp cigarettes. Ragged gray flakes of cigarette ash dotted the yellow top of the desk and the green blotter in the papers that were there. A buff-curtained window, 8 or 10 inches open, let in from the court a current of air faintly scented with ammonia. So this description, it's just you're looking at it. You know, it's not just a security camera, I guess. It's also smell-o-vision to get into where you are. Miss Wonderly watched the gray flakes twitch and crawl. Her eyes were uneasy. She sat on the very edge of the chair. Her feet were flat on the floor, as if she were about to rise. Her hands and dark gloves clasped a flat dark handbag in her lap. Spade rocked back in his chair and asked, "Now what can I do for you, Miss Wonderly?" She caught her breath and looked at him. She swallowed and said hurriedly, "Could you? I thought, that is. Then she tortured her lower lip with glistening teeth and said nothing. Only her dark eyes spoke now, pleading. Spade smiled and nodded as if he understood her, but pleasantly, as if nothing serious were involved. He said, "Suppose you tell me about it, from the beginning. Then we'll know what needs doing. Better begin as far back as you can." So it's interesting. I mean, it would be very easy to say Spade thought she was this and that, and the Miss Wonderly thought Spade was blah, 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 and felt this and that. So I like the extra bit. Now, the descriptions can get out of hand. I know some authors, Steinbeck, you know, the others, who sometimes the descriptions can be just a bit much that you're putting out there. But if it's done in the right scene, it's, I think a rule of writing, I mean, I have a fiction book I worked on 10 years ago and I abandoned it. I would like to return to it at some point. I really would. But like I do with my nonfiction books, I'd say with my fiction book, every word matters. Every word matters. Treat every word as being precious. So don't overuse words when you don't have to. Stunk and White's Elements of Style, their rule, omit unnecessary words. So that's first, second, and third person, third being omniscient and limited POV. Lots of different books that use these. What's your favorite point of view in literature? Have you read any good books lately? I've had a lot that I've gone through. A third person one, let me think off the top of my head, third person I've gone through. Kafka's Metamorphosis, Gregor Samsa woke up one day and he was a bug. Like, without having to go into his head, "I'm a bug, what's going on here?" Third person works well there. Third person is used also in stories where first person wouldn't work as well, like Call of the Wild. So Jack London, about a dog named Buck that gets kidnapped, taken up to Alaska, and he learns about his primeval roots, you know, goes, you know, with the wolves and stuff. The third person tells us a little bit what Buck is thinking, but it's more bringing out from his actions and saying, Buck didn't like this or that, but not like, Buck's like, "Ruff, ruff, I don't like this at all," you know? And so it's neat to make the dog a character, and the third person makes it not cheesy, not like Air Bud or something, you know, for a dog to be the main character or something. What else have I been going through? A Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. So that would be... Okay, I looked it up here on Cliff Notes because I was wondering, wait, why can't I fully remember A Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich? Why can't I remember the POV very clearly? It's kind of a combination, and some of these are combinations. So it was Alexander Solzhenitsyn. I'm sorry, I'm butchering that for my Russian listeners. It says here, he used a form of narration which is an ingenious variation of a traditional Russian narrative form, the skaz. This technique, employed widely in Russian folktales, establishes an anonymous narrator who is on the same educational and social level as the protagonist and is able to transmit the main character's actions and thoughts using the third person singular and sometimes the first person plural, but giving the impression to the reader that the story is being told in first person by the protagonist. Indeed, in One Day, the reader has the impression that Ivan is the narrator, and only a closer look reveals that most of the story is told in third person. The reader sees through Ivan's eyes, although Ivan is not the narrator. Well, look at that. I was just thinking, I just read the book. And I was confused. Like, wait, was it first or was it third person? I genuinely couldn't remember, whereas other books, it's just very clear to me. And that is why, because it's a hybrid storytelling that uses, it kind of filters first person through a very special kind of third person narrator. So there you go. Literature. Ain't it great? And maybe once I get through a few more stories, I'll do another free-for-all on the favorite books I've been reading so far. Maybe Laura says I should maybe do a book club with people, maybe with my patrons. I don't know. It might be fun at some point. I'm not sure, but we'll see. Well, thank you guys so much for listening with me, and I hope you have a blessed weekend, and maybe pick up a good book and see what perks your interest.